You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 31st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author William Hartung, author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. On the Military-Industrial Complex. Today on the program, we'll be talking about the debt vote scheduled for today, but for after when the markets close. We wouldn't want to scare those shareholders at all. An update on Los Indignados. Apparently, massive protests happening in Europe. You wouldn't know it to watch the news. And maybe those protests will come here. More in that as the show progresses. Some upshot. Last week, all but eight Democrats endorsed demands that Obama come up with plans this summer to accelerate the withdrawal of U.S. forces and pursue a negotiated settlement with all interested parties in Afghanistan, including the Taliban. This was an amendment offered to the annual defense authorization bill. It failed, but only narrowly so, 215 to 204, 26 Republicans joining the vast majority of Democrats. The bill, or amendment, I should say, was sponsored by Massachusetts Representative Jim McGovern, the rep from Worcester, Mass. Shout out. My homeboy. Basically took out a fixed timetable for the withdrawal. I mean, this is a largely meaningless vote, although it hopefully will create some pressure on the Obama administration. Last July, McGovern lost badly with only with 98 Democrats opposing him. This time, many of the Democrats joined in voting for three separate reports. Within 60 days, a plan for accelerated withdrawal of U.S. forces. Within 60 days, a plan to pursue accelerated talks with the Kabul government, Taliban, and Pakistan toward reconciliation of the internal conflict in Afghanistan. Within 90 days, a new national intelligence estimate from the administration on the leadership, locations, and capabilities of al-Qaeda and its affiliated networks following bin Laden's death. White House largely dismissed the vote, but I got to imagine that at least they're aware that there's some pressure. So I guess that's good. Meanwhile, on the flip side of the ledger, the economy looks like it's sputtering, folks. And there could be no worse time for the type of austerity measures that are being discussed now that the Republicans have, and we will get into this more on the dynamics of the debt vote, but you know, it's the age-old question. I don't know if the Democrats blew this or it's just simply part of their agenda. But the economy is sputtering big time. Manufacturing cooling, according to Wall Street Journal. Housing market at a close to an all-time low. People just don't want to. People just don't have the money. They don't have the jobs. They still have these massive mortgages. Half their houses are an enormous amount of people have their houses underwater, as it were. Their mortgage, their loan is larger than the value of their home. So they're frozen in time. They can't sell without paying money. And still, we are seeing anemic efforts by the administration to revamp and modify loans. So the economy not looking great. Meanwhile, a bright spot, I mentioned it the other day, now we're seeing more of it. On Friday, President Obama will visit a Chrysler Group plant in Toledo where he will argue the administration's auto bailout was a success. I don't know how you can measure it in any other way. Washington Post, the auto industry's rebound poses a challenge for Republicans because many of them argued against using $80 billion in taxpayer dollars to try and save General Motors. In 2008, for example, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney wrote an opinion article headlined, "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt." But last week, a spokesman for Mr. Romney said the former Massachusetts governor deserves credit for coming up with the bankruptcy process that Obama implemented at GM and Chrysler, though he didn't believe the government should have provided the financing. As opposed to whom? I guess Romney was going to provide it himself. The two automakers have hired or brought back nearly 15,000 auto workers with plans to hire 4,000 more. GM and Chrysler are making money for the first time in a decade. Sales continue to rise. I guess it just didn't lead down to that path of horrid socialism and failure that everyone in the Republican Party said it would. It's just stunning. It was a stunning, stunning, stunning success. And I suspect it'll be even more of a success as time goes on. All right, folks, we have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to William Hartung on our military-industrial complex. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program William Hartung, senior research fellow in the New America Foundation's American Strategy Program. He is also the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to touch on just what's happening in terms of the New START treaty and the attempts of the Republicans to, like everything else, it seems, to defund the execution of that treaty. But before we get there, let's talk about your book and I guess more generally the state of the military-industrial complex. You used the story of Lockheed Martin through the years as a prime example of that. Why them?
Well, they're the biggest weapons contractor. They get about $36 billion a year from the U.S. government, almost twice the budget of the State Department. They're involved not just in nuclear weapons and fighter planes, but also they're now working for Homeland Security, for the CIA, even in domestic areas like the IRS and the census and other domestic affairs. So they're kind of a model of how the military industry is branching out and becoming kind of an all-purpose government security industry. So I thought between the size and the kind of the areas that they've got their fingers in. I thought they were a good example.
I mean, is this, has the die been set? I mean, you had Eisenhower basically warned us 60-some-odd years ago of this problem. Has there ever been an attempt to address it? Is it just all she wrote at this point?
Well, there's been efforts over the years. Late William Proxmire tried to keep them from getting bailed out in the early 70s. He lost by one vote. There's been issues about the revolving door where people go from the companies into government, from government to the companies. And so this kind of ongoing conflict of interest, and people have been prosecuted for that, gone to jail. There's been changes in reporting requirements. There's been attempts to try to limit their political contributions. So people have taken a stab at it, but the overall power of the lobby, I don't think, has been diminished significantly.
So what, I mean, is there, where does this lead us? I mean, we have our defense budget has doubled in the past 10 years. We're now facing austerity cuts and a sort of almost a concerted effort, it seems, to create a new normal of unemployment and stagnated wages. Where does this end?
Well, I think there have been cases in the past where the complex has taken a hit. It was cut by a third at the end of the Cold War. There were significant cuts after Vietnam. So it's not out of the question that in these next couple years you could see cuts 10-15% or more. So that would take a little bit of pressure off the domestic cuts. But it's really, it's kind of a bigger policy issue. What are you going to do about revenues? What are you going to do about the Pentagon? Are they going to be able to undermine entitlement? So it's part of the puzzle, but it's not the whole picture. But I think the arms lobby, as tenacious as it is, will take some hits.
And do you see our continued involvement? I mean, we're now waging, depending on who you ask, three wars, the longest of which are now entering close to its 10th year. Is our entire foreign policy rationale more, how much of it is a function of the economic forces and the relationship with the military industrial complex, I guess?
Well, I don't think it's the lead element, but it kind of puts a floor under it in the sense that if your main instruments of power are military, I think you're more likely to gravitate towards a military solution. So, for example, as I mentioned, if you've got one contractor getting almost twice what the State Department gets, it makes it hard to engage in diplomacy. But I think there's also obviously ideological issues of war and terror, who's the enemy, kind of American exceptionalism. But I think the size of the military-industrial complex makes it much easier to choose war as an option.
And how is this broken? I mean, I guess my concern is that we have this floor in which we cannot go under, and that there seemed to be a real concerted effort after the fall of the Soviet Union to find a new boogeyman. And I mean, there was such a passion, it seems, in some respects, to find this new boogeyman. And it, for a while, it seemed like we were flailing around and trying to create this boogeyman out of China. And then over time, we were able to sort of create this East-West divide with the Middle East. How can the citizenry in any way sort of stick a stick in this spoke?
Well, I think it's, unfortunately, so far it's been issue by issue. But I think now that there's a lot of public concern about the deficit, one of the things that's come up is why are we spending, up to $3 billion a month on Iraq and Afghanistan, $3 billion a week, I'm sorry. And so I think that is going to create some leverage to at least push the drawdown to be a withdrawal in Iraq and start shaving back in Afghanistan. So I think if people start yelling about the money, I think there can be some effect.
And to what extent do you think we're going to see any changes with Leon Panetta coming in at the Defense Department in terms of like what it tells us about future funding going forward?
Well, unlike Gates, he's not straight out of the Defense Department, and Gates was, you know, Bush's defense secretary. He's been head of the OMB, the White House Budget Office. So I think, you know, if Obama wanted to make cuts, I think Panetta, also with his congressional experience, would be able to push them through. But I think it really comes from the top. I mean, if Obama's going to play the kind of game he played with Gates, where they went after a few programs like the F-22, even as the overall budget was increasing, then Panetta's not going to make a difference. But if Obama sort of sees the light, even in a modest sense, and says, you know, we can't fight three wars, we can't afford to spend the most we've spent since World War II at a time when the, you know, everybody else has taken a huge hit from the budget, then I think Panetta would be a good implementer. But I don't think he's going to be an independent force for cuts.
Do you think that when a president like Obama enters office, one with no experience, no relationship, pre-existing relationships with the military, and no sort of general association, that he is more likely to be rolled, to be intimidated, that he needs to, in some ways, sort of shore up that flank? I mean, I just look at things like, it's not directly related, but I'm not convinced the dynamic is not the same, that, you know, as a candidate, as a senator, he had real problems with the Patriot Act, and now we have extended this regime for 4 years with virtually no debate. I wonder if that isn't a large factor in maintaining the sort of the dominance of this military, I guess now you could say, security industrial complex.
I think it is a factor. I mean, if you look at somebody like Eisenhower, he was a general, a war hero. He was able to push back a little bit, slow the rate of growth, get rid of some of the ridiculous weapons that the Air Force was pushing, you know, kind of keep a lid even during the Cold War on what the military wanted to spend. Obama, you know, he kept Gates, Bush's defense secretary, partly for that reason, that he felt like he needed to cover his flank. And Gates, I think, has been very skillful at kind of giving the impression of cuts without making cuts. And so, you know, Obama left on his own. You know, if you look at the fights over Afghanistan, where he was sort of fought to a standstill by some of the military folks, he probably would have gone deeper in cuts if it left to his own devices. I think that is a problem. He would need, I think, to be willing to take more political risks and you know, speak out against, to some degree, the military or retired military leadership. And he doesn't seem like he's been willing to do that so far.
The Democrats, at least the majority, a vast majority of them in the House, voted in support of an amendment which just failed, just barely, on the defense authorization bill, which would have, without actually providing any type of a timetable for withdrawal, it did set up a couple of timetables for reports that would theoretically strengthen or at least sort of tie the administration down to some type of timetable of sorts. When the Democrats vote in that way, does it help Obama if he is actually looking to get out of Afghanistan to be able to say that, like, look, we're starting to lose congressional support here?
I think it does. I think, you know, and the reason that the House was able to do that was sort of the two B's, Bin Laden and the budget. You know, they can say if it was about Bin Laden, that's been resolved. And in any case, we can't afford to keep doing this. And that's why I think the numbers jumped from what they had been in past years. But I think it helps Obama to say, I'm not the only one who feels this way. We've got, you know, we're moving towards a majority in the House that likewise thinks it's time to wind this thing down. So I think it's got to be a plus in terms of those of us who like to see that war, you know, ended as soon as possible.
Well, I mean, when that war, if that were a war, were to end, what would be the circumstances that would we would leave in our wake? I mean, it would it necessarily involve essentially the Taliban coming back in and being part of some type of negotiated agreement?
I think that's the likely outcome. You know, I don't know if any administration would just say, look, we've spent 10 years here. Good luck, folks. You know, so I think there would have to be some kind of coalition government, especially given that Karzai has been, you know, far from a sterling leader with this corruption and kind of erratic behavior. So that is a wild card because, you know, if, you know, say they can't get that done, then what's their rationale for getting out? I think it's harder, although not impossible.
All right, I want to turn just to you recently wrote a piece in Huffington Post, Strange Love Strikes Again, in reference to the New START treaty. Tell us first, give us a brief recap of what this New START treaty is. How is it different from the old START treaty, except for that it's been ratified now? And what are the Republicans doing to or attempt to defund its implementation?
Well, I'd say the two big benefits of the New START treaty are, first of all, it cuts the nuclear arsenals in the U.S. and Russia by about a third. Second of all, it reinstitutes verification procedures, ways to monitor the other side to make sure they're complying with the agreement, which with that in place, it makes it easier to move to further reductions. But I think it's by itself, it's fairly modest. But if it were to build towards things like further U.S.-Russian reductions, getting tactical nuclear weapons out of Europe, you know, moving towards a test ban, then it would have been it's well worth the fight that was had with the Congress, which came at a high price because Obama pledged to do things like pour $185 billion over 10 years into the nuclear weapons complex and more nuclear weapons delivery vehicles. So he made a kind of a, you know, a dangerous bargain to get this thing done. And that's exactly the bargain that the House now is trying to make sort of written in stone before they're willing to support even the most basic measures towards implementing the treaty.
So are we less safe with only 1,550 warheads shared amongst us? I mean, should we be worried that we don't have 3,000 warheads?
No, I think, if anything, we should be worried that there's still too many. I mean, you know, in terms of the old kind of deterrent strategy, 1,500 is more than enough to destroy Russia or any other country many times over.
Oh, so, thank God.
You know, so that... The question is, can you get beyond that? Can you get to, you know, much lower levels into the hundreds? And then if you did that, could you have some sort of, you know, global agreement on going to zero? And that would be years down the road, but I think that's a good goal, which Obama committed himself to in a speech in Prague. But then he said, you know, kind of in the fine print, I don't expect this to happen in my lifetime. You know, so that I think that's a much longer horizon that I could live with, you know, given that obviously he's not going to be president for that long and he's going to have influence over whether this happens.
When we have this many nuclear warheads, is this simply a function of that military-industrial complex? I mean, is there any rational security reasons for this at this point?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think there's this kind of couple sides of it. One is, of course, the companies do very well sustaining the complex, and they're drooling over the idea of building new nuclear submarines, new ballistic missiles, new bombers, new, you know, bomb factories. But then you've got sort of the nuclear priesthood in the Pentagon, which is still kind of stuck in Cold War mode. You know, they would like to hit every possible target you could imagine in Russia and elsewhere, you know, two or three times each. So you have to kind of, you know, dislodge that nuclear priesthood, and then you also have to stand up to the company. So it's kind of a, you know, a kind of a two-front war, if you will, to really get more control over this.
Do these companies, I mean, the companies that are, you know, looking at the potential for $185 billion flowing through their coffers, I would imagine that they are the ones who are sort of fueling this priesthood, as you describe it. I mean, what is their sell to people who think that we need to bomb every possible target in Russia multiple times?
Well, I think it's fear and ignorance. You know, they fund a lot of the right-wing think tanks like Heritage, like places like the National Institute for Public Policy and the Center for Security Policy, all of which sort of have argued that even the modest cuts in START leave us, you know, completely exposed to nuclear attack or at least nuclear blackmail. The notion that, you know, a country like Russia or even Iran is going to say, you know, we're going to take this action, you can't do anything about it because we have, you know, you're not possible to attack us. So, but I think if you look at the numbers, you know, as I was saying, at the levels we're at, no country would be idiotic enough to actually attack the United States. So, a lot of it, I think, is kind of, you know, Cold War logic and kind of ginning up as much fear as they can gin up about North Korea and Iran, even given that, you know, they're kind of very modest powers compared to what happened in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, which actually could destroy the United States.
Do you, and what are the chances that the Republicans will be successful in some way gumming up the works here? Is there do you think that the Senate will hold strong on and reject the anything the House presents in terms of amendments, or is this something that is possibly becomes another political football?
I think the Senate can and should hold firm. I guess the question is, you know, what kind of Senate are we going to have after 2012? Because if the Democrats lose control of the Senate, then all bets are off in terms of something like this, as outrageous as it is.
All right. Well, William Hartung, thank you very much for joining us. The book is Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Really appreciate your taking the time today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
We got to take a break, folks. We will be right back. And when we do, we'll be talking about the upcoming debt vote and Los Indignados. Be right back. So today, ladies and gentlemen, in the House, our Congress people will be voting on a clean debt limit bill. In other words, they're going to be voting on what is the and has been traditionally the most uncontroversial of all votes. That is, to allow the government to continue to borrow money to pay for the budgets that it passes. A year and a half ago, we were talking about Rand Paul saying, well, I would vote against the debt limit ceiling, but I know that it would pass, so I don't really worry about that vote. I'm doing it to show that I am fiscally responsible. Well, today the Republicans will vote on the administration's request that the $14.3 trillion debt ceiling be lifted without any accompanying spending reductions. This vote is being brought up so that it would fail to, I guess, as part of this kabuki theater, that we're supposed to believe that Republicans will not increase the debt ceiling. The only problem with this kabuki theater is that we know every Republican leader has already said we will pass, we will raise the debt limit ceiling. And so this is being used within the Beltway establishment circles and within the administration to justify some program of cuts to Medicare. And in fact, Mitch McConnell was on one of those crappy shows over the weekend. I don't think it was a cartoon, although it may have very well have been, saying that Medicare has to be part of this. Why is he saying this? Because he knows that the Republicans are an untenable situation with their support for destroying Medicare. And the only way to blunt the political implications of their now on record desire to destroy Medicare as we know it. You can call it whatever you want. The fact of the matter is they want to destroy Medicare. Medicare is a program where the government provides health insurance for people over the age of 65. And they want to destroy that. They want to instead have the government give limited vouchers to seniors and throw them into the private insurance market, where the cost of their health insurance will be at least three times larger than those voucher payments. That's not Medicare. That's a subsidy to buy private health insurance, which would be definitionally the most expensive health insurance in the country. Because insurance companies make their money off of the people who aren't going to get sick. And so if they get a whole new pool of people over the age of 65 who are the most likely to be sick, their rates are going to be astronomical. So McConnell is insisting that this be part of the deal so that when 2012 comes, the Democrats will not be able to say, hey, these guys want to destroy Medicare, because the Republicans will be able to say, hey, we all voted on this together. And those rational of you would say, man, Democrats would be completely idiotic to fall for this, to cave into this, and or Democrats must agree that Medicare should be cut. All the while when we know that we are allowing multimillionaires to pay the smallest amount of taxes by any measure that you can come up with since 1950. The vote will be held after the markets close today. House leaders do not want a repeat of the September 2008 vote in which the House first rejected the $700 billion Wall Street bailout and triggered the single largest drop in one day of stock prices history. Meanwhile, just days before, Washington Post reports House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp, Republican from Michigan, has been working the phones in conversations with top banking executives to explain the politics of next week's planned debt limit vote in the House. I'm sorry, this is according to Politico. The vote will be on a measure to raise the $14.2 trillion debt limit with no spending cuts. With the GOP majority and many Democrats opposing this clean vote approach, it will fail. But Camp has made the case to Wall Street that the vote is just a political marker intended to make clear that significant cuts will be required when emergency measures run out and the markets could begin to take possible default more seriously. In other words, this is a stunt. We will raise the debt limit no matter what. Don't you worry. Now, if Politico knows this, and I know this, and you know this, it's impossible to imagine that the Obama administration and the leadership of the Democratic Senate don't know this. So this is a game of chicken with the cost to Republicans being extraordinarily high, because they are making promises to Wall Street that they will not F this up. And Democrats can make them F this up. You know, last week we talked about Bill Clinton corralling Paul Ryan at a Peterson Foundation meeting and saying, hey, if you need to talk to me about, you know, what we need to do here, give me a call. I hope the Democrats don't use this as an excuse to do nothing on Medicare. The same Bill Clinton back in 2005, when George Bush was talking about destroying Social Security, said, I think the Democrats should say what they are for on Social Security. In other words, not I'm for Social Security, but what they're willing to change. So Clinton's political antenna has either been off for many years, or perhaps his neoliberal tendencies just always seem to get the best of him. But we shall see more on that tomorrow. You know, the real question is, what's coming out of those Biden talks? We hear Steny Hoyer talk about how Medicare cuts are on the table. We just don't know. We just don't know how strong the sentiment for self-survival is with Democrats in the Senate. To the extent that Democrats have any chance of retaining the Senate, and people were talking about this 2-4 years ago, that you've got 33 Senate seats coming up for a vote, maybe more with retirements at this point. Something like 21 of them are Democrats. Statistically, the odds are the Democrats are going to lose the Senate. But New York 26 taught us one thing, that this is a winning issue. When you talk about destroying Medicare to protect the tax cuts of multimillionaires, 80 to 90% of the American public is with you. The Republican, in just a year and a half ago, won with 75% of the vote. And this time around, lost by 6 percentage points. Meanwhile, maybe a shape of things to come. In those countries in Europe, you know, we've talked about the protests that are going on, UK Uncut in Great Britain. I think it was on the membership show. Somebody sent me a link to the Los Indignados. And there is a stunning movement of protest taking root in Europe. Last week, May 26th, the streets of Madrid are thick with a sense of optimism and hope. The city's main square has become a tent city occupied by groups inspired by uprisings across the Arab world. What started as a fringe protest against rising unemployment and the Spanish government's multi-billion euro bank bailout, which led to severe austerity, escalated after several activists were arrested by police and held for 48 hours. A demonstration against the arrest was organized in the city's main square, Puerta del Sol. The numbers soon snowballed. What began as a group of fewer than 100 activists reached an estimated 50,000 people within less than 6 days. We cannot find a job. We cannot find a house. We cannot find health from the state, said Alejandro Jalón, a 20-year-old student. I'm here because I think we can change something. In the space of a few days, they had created separate working commissions to form proposals for change to the government, current government policy, a social and migration commission, which would look at immigration policy, the health commission, focus on how to deprivatize healthcare services. Other commissions were formed to handle politics, education, the economy, and the environment. Days later, Spanish police ended up firing rubber bullets and swung truncheons to disperse anti-crisis protesters in a Barcelona square on Friday, as cleaning crews cleaned their tent. The demonstrators are known variously as the Indignant M15 after the birth date of their movement and the Spanish Revolution. Meanwhile, on Sunday, as reported by Jerome Ruse from Roar Magazine, 100,000 Greeks marched on Parliament to protest against the EU IMF austerity measures and demand real democracy now. Here's what that sounds like. Here's number one. That's a lot of people. And I'll tell you something, they come with whistles. and pots and pans. It's been an incredibly peaceful protest, but people are rising up. Let's cut to, this is Greeks protesting loudly in Syntagma Square in Athens after 6 days. What you can't see in the video is they're waving their hands, almost like, I guess, like one of those burlesque shows up in the air. It's back and forth, back and forth. It's pretty stunning. Meanwhile, back in Spain, Beatriz Perez, a 29-year-old spokeswoman for the movement, acknowledged the influence of the recent UK student protests. It says that Egypt and Tunisia were very important catalysts for the movement in Spain. Manuel Ferrara, a 66-year-old retired engineer, says the scenes of Puerta del Sol remind him of the student protests in France during the summer of 1968. These are known as the 68ards. 68ards, the 68ers. Many people believe that the Situationist International, you'll recall my Situationist International fetish that led to the ill-fated Bad Situationist film, that many of those protests were actually just sort of essentially started by the work of literally a handful of Situationists who were putting up these very cool graphics and subversive posters around the city. I don't know. There's some controversy as to how much they started it, but nevertheless, it was in the air at the time. It's the same war against capital, against power, against politicians, against the establishment, and so on, explains. The Puerta del Sol protest is more significant because through Facebook and the internet, this movement is worldwide. I think I'm living in a new world order. Well, one can only hope. We're going to try and get somebody on to give us an update on those happenings around in Europe. And lastly, in this country, Huffington Post, Dave Jameson, reports on some grocery store workers going on a hunger strike over their stagnant wages. Jose Garcia, a 52-year-old Mexican immigrant, works the overnight shift cleaning floors inside Cub Foods store in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It is unclear what his immigration status is, I should say. Despite his long tenure, I don't think that makes a difference, although it may explain his incapacity to have any advocate, although he seems to be going public with this. Despite his long tenure with the same cleaning company, Garcia says he earns a wage of $9 an hour, more or less the same rate he was making when he started cleaning floors back in 2002. Taking inflation into account, his salary has effectively gone down since he started working with the cleaning crew. 9 years, and your salary goes down. There are times when he can't afford as much food as he'd like. He says it pains him to see workers at the store throw out unsold perishables like roasted chicken at the end of the night. It's perfectly good food, he says through a translator. In the past, when he's asked if he can take the food home, he says he's been told that under-the-table giveaways are against store rules. Sometimes he resorts to visiting the charitable food pantries around town, picking up the food that has often come from being thrown out from these grocery stores. He's employed by a company called Carlson Building Maintenance, which is a contract to wax and buff the floors inside Cub Food stores. Although they had once been a decent paying union jobs, a lot of the cleaning and other grunt work in grocery and retail stores now gets farmed out to third-party contractors like Carlson. Sometimes a Carlson will even then subcontract that work at a certain price point. If the subcontractor can't meet it, they find another one. It drives the wages down. I started out working thinking I would make more money at some point, says Garcia. The 9 years have gone by. Instead of things getting better, things have gotten worse. Despite the stagnant pay, his workload has increased. They have less guys now cleaning these stores. This is the exact same story as that garbage worker from Madison that I interviewed in Madison. Wages stagnant. pension threatened, all the while through his 19 years, they've been working him harder and harder and harder and harder. He said he didn't have the opportunity to go to college. So he's worked hard at a job that pays, frankly, crap money, with the promise that at one day he'll reach the age of 65, 67, get a guaranteed pension, and be able to live his retirement years, his senior years, his last years, with some sense that he's not going to have to worry about the roof over his head. He's not going to have to worry about putting food on the table. Maybe he can add something to his grandkids and kids' education. But that apparently is too much to ask in this country now. Garcia has no family, but he does support a mother and a wheelchair-bound sister in Mexico. He sends $300 or $400 there a month. Garcia and a former co-worker, who was fired, incidentally, for trying to organize the workers, are in the midst of a hunger strike, posting up at an encampment in Minneapolis to bring attention to their plight. One of the organizers, Veronica Mendez, said most grocery store cleaners in the area are earning just around $7.50 or $8 an hour, doing more work than they did a few years ago. The Minneapolis City Council has taken notice of the workers' plight, and it passed a resolution on Friday saying that retail cleaning workers have been seeing good-paying jobs to $10 to $11 per hour deteriorate into jobs barely paying minimum wage over the past 10 years. Amy Rottenberg, a spokesman for Carlson, here's the game, folks, says the company offers fair and competitive wages given the current job market woes. In other words, this 9% unemployment, this pervasive unemployment, is having its desired effect. It is driving down wages. That's how you have record corporate profits. At a time where demand is so soft, where the only reason why consumer spending is up is because food and oil cost more. She says, this is a very challenging economy and a very tight market. And these are entry-level unskilled jobs. And frankly, if we want to get into a discussion of what's a living wage, that's for Congress to decide and not us as private businesses. So there you have it, folks. Report released earlier this year by the National Employment Law Project found that lower wage industries accounted for half the job growth during the first year of the post-recession rebound. So if you got a job out there, congratulations. It'll be one that doesn't pay a prevailing living wage. Well, that's Congress's problem. Good luck with that. For those of you who are making a living wage or a little better, think about becoming a member of the Majority Report, please. We need 70 new members in the next 2 weeks to hit projections. And so if you can afford it, then only if you can afford it. If you can't, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But if you can afford it, and you listen to the show on a regular basis, you appreciate what you hear, please think about becoming a member. 50 cents a show, folks. Seriously? And you know you're only going to get more value as time goes on. At the very least, I hope you're buying stuff through Amazon, our Amazon link, and buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Coffee prices are up. You can get a 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. This is almost like me supporting you. Fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, it's delicious. And it's under the average gourmet coffee prices. My God, folks. All right, join me on the flip side, Majority FM. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I will take your phone calls. Hear about my plum tree, my eczema, and of course we talk stories. That's where we learned about the Los Ignorados. through our post-show chat. Members only. All right, folks. See you on the flip side.